Well, let's begin. We have a number of folks on. I want to welcome you all to the Richard Wileman Quarterly Town Hall Meeting. We are always excited about this call. I'm Dick Harris. I'm Director of Executive Coaching on Richard's team, and I'll be hosting today's call. Those of you who are on, you know that this is an information-sharing discussion open to all Wileman Center members, and it's really specifically designed to talk about what's on your mind, you know, your concerns, your ideas, and questions. And we've received a number of great questions over the past several weeks from financial services professionals, both across the U.S. and across Canada, such as yourselves, and we want to get to those. Richard's on the line, and he'll be making some additional comments and some opening comments in a minute. To the point, to the question that was just raised, actually, I'm getting some static now from somebody, maybe on a cell phone. I'm not sure if we can do anything about that. But what I would like to ask is no one who is on the call, please put your phone on hold. Do not put your phone on hold while on the call. Whether you're aware of it or not, it either causes disruption to the quality of the sound or sometimes, you know, music will come on and we cannot conduct the call. So please, no one put it on. And I will repeat this in about 10 minutes for those, maybe some folks who are coming on after this announcement. So it's a live call. It's taped. It will be on the Wileman Center after this if you want to revisit it. We're really looking forward to it. So what I'd like to do now is introduce Mr. Richard Wileman. Richard, you may have some opening comments, sir.
Well, thank you, Dick, and just briefly, because I know we have a lot of questions from the email I received. But first things first, of course, welcome everyone. I think the thing we need to really be thinking about is to really see about what's going on today in the market. And what's crystal clear to all of us, in fact, I'm writing an op-ed piece about the power shift. And what we've seen is this enormous power shift from the seller to the buyer. In other words, organizations really have to abandon, advisors have to abandon the whole idea of slogans and unique selling propositions and, frankly, giving lip service about service. There's no question today that today's customer wants a promise of high-level outcome upfront and unconditional. So they don't care your years of experience and your great service platform and you're number one and you're on the Barron's list, you're MDR, whatever you are. All they care about is one thing. Can you really think like they think? And more importantly, can you communicate from their point of view? And that is the driver in the business today. Men's Warehouse is a brilliant example of they had gained tremendous market share. Their CEO had a great message. You're going to love the way you look. They pushed him out of the company. The new CEO comes in with his, quote, advertising agency. And now they are advertising and telling people that we are have been dressing gentlemen for 30 years. The truth is nobody cares. Their store traffic's down. Their number run is down. They've stopped pressing suits when people come in for free. And what's happened is they really focused on being, come if you will, business-centric as opposed to becoming consumer-centric. My prediction is the old CEO is going to be back in the seat by the first of the year based on the fact that they have completely lost their way in the marketplace, and they're trying to shift the power back to the seller when, in fact, the consumer demonstrates the shift to the buyer. And in reality, if you think about our business and financial services, the reality is today you must communicate in and from the perspective of the, shall we say, prospect or client. So with that said, Dick, let's do a few questions.
That's great. That's great. Okay, going to start in with, we've got three town hall questions that came in, and I'm going to, initially, we'll start with those. The first one is from an advisor in Manhattan. His question is this, Richard. How do I effectively network at events? By demonstrating an interest in the individual as opposed to appearing to be just another self-serving business card distributor. He's asking, do I employ a different method for an obvious business-centric event as compared to a social or charitable event? Your thoughts, sir?
No, this is a great question. First things first, your goal when you go to any event, social or business-centric as he defined it, the goal is not to go with your automatic business card wrist shooter strapped on. The goal is to build relationships and connections with people. So look at it like a connectivity event. So how do you effectively network and by demonstrating interest in the individual? Well, by doing exactly that. Instead of asking them, what do you do, which everybody loves to ask, the reality is if you're at an event, let's say it's an event of individuals in a specific type of business or a specific type of association, or even if it's a social event, ask, when you meet people, ask them, how long have you been involved in, and then how long have you been involved in the American Cancer Society? How long have you been involved in the automotive business? How long have you been a neurosurgeon? How long have you been involved in the medical community here in New York? By doing that, that opens the door and people then will engage you in conversation. The objective here is not to pass out a business card, but the objective is to engage them at a deeper level. There's a great book, you can still get it. It's out of print, but I've seen it on Amazon and others, called The Friendship Factor, The Friendship Factor. I don't recall the author, but it's a great little book that talks about how to engage people in conversation. For those of you who, with online, go up to the Wildman Center, go to Accelerate Your Growth in the Affluent Market, and go to the Social Prospecting class, and take that course, and it really details out how to engage people in a social setting or a business setting. And after you have a conversation, then you can simply turn to them and say, you know, Maurice, I really enjoy spending time with you personally. I'd like the privilege of introducing myself to you professionally. So let's have breakfast for lunch one day next week. And after we have a conversation, we can decide if we need to bring it up again. That type of an approach has a huge impact as opposed to passing out business card. One other thing, whether it's business-centric or social or charitable, you might well be served to have a personal card. This differs from a business card. And what I mean by that is when I say it differs, it actually differs. In other words, it is a personal card, meaning it has your name, your personal email, your personal cell phone on it. You can simply hand this to an individual and say, hey, I'd love to get together and have lunch with you. Here's my card, and that individual will give you their card. The point is, by giving a personal card, it doesn't say the only reason I'm here is a self-serving business card distributor. It says I'm here focused on people. Now, a follow-up to that is you can simply say, here's my personal card. The only thing that's not on here is my office number. First question they're going to ask is, oh, what do you do? Your response? You know, I'm a financial advisor with ABC, and what my best clients say is articulate your value promise and then suggest you have breakfast and lunch one day next week so we can have a conversation to decide if we need to bring it up again. If you go to the Wildman Center, go to the Resource Center, go under networking, download the template for the personal card. It's right there already for you. Fill in your name, your personal email, and your personal phone number. Again, this is nothing about business. This is just a way to present yourself so that you are seen as a person, not as a business card distributor. Nick?
Good one. Next question is from a member new to the Wildman Center, and her question is this. Richard, would you walk me through how I can find membership lists and contact information for a niche market that I'm looking at? I think somebody new to the research end of it, Richard, and just wondering how to start with contact information and membership.
Understood. I think the most important thing is the Research Center on the Wildman Center. We now have every single four-digit SIC code in the country, every one of them, and many, many, many charitable organizations, cultural, et cetera. So first things first, go to the Research Center. Scroll into and type in the market, that the niche market you are apparently attempting to penetrate. It will take you to a market brief. Click on the links there. Those are the national associations we know that individuals in the niche market belong to, and they're set up by niche. And then just go to the local chapter. It's three clicks. Join, look up the state association, the local association, right through the Research Center. That's the first thing. Secondly, you can obviously just go online to Google and type in, you know, pick a market. The a local dry cleaning association in Chicago is ? And with Google's new search capability, it'll come right up. Bing is now pretty good at this. They're not as good as Google, but it's not bad. And what they'll do is, again, pull up the association that you want to target. And candidly, most of them have the list available to you and the contact information available for you as well. So that's another approach. A third one is Hoover's is just Hoover.com has just elevated their platform, finally. I mean, it's been years of complaints, but the bottom line is they've just upgraded their platform. You can go to Hoover's, too, and you can search for a membership list and contact information in a niche market. But the best and easiest way to find it is use the research center, go to the association. Almost every association lists their membership list online. I was in L.A. last week. An advisor, I was in a restaurant, and anyway, long story short, he came up, had a conversation with him. I'm having a hard, I just pulled it up on my iPad. Give me your market. I typed it in. Here it is. Boom. Here's the board of directors right there. All you got to do is type in the name of the, in his case, was the Dry Cleaning Association of Los Angeles County. And I just typed that in, and up came, and there's a membership list right there online. And most of the time, you can find it. Now, if you're in country clubs or recreational organizations, it's often a bit more difficult because that information is not readily available. But I've found that if you'll simply go to the club, go to the organization, and get involved, you'll have an opportunity to have access to the membership list.
Another great question, Richard. This one's from somebody who's been with us for a while and is working a market and is stuck. And what they're saying is this. This is from Florida. I'm targeting a specific type of orthopedic surgeons, and you need to be an orthopedic surgeon to join this association. Are there other ways to gain membership information? In other words, he seems blocked out because he's not a surgeon, but he wants to work the market. Any ideas on that one, sir?
Well, a couple of things. Obviously, if you can't join the association as a vendor or supplier member, that creates its own challenge, one. Two, what you can often do is check and see if there is a surgeon's auxiliary in your area. Many, many, particularly metropolitan areas, and I'm not talking about the New York, Chicago's, and L.A.'s. I'm talking about a normal mid-sized city. Almost every organization has an auxiliary. Orthopedic surgeons may have an orthopedic surgeon's auxiliary. This is made up of spouses who support the association and support the surgeon. Almost anybody can join that organization. That gives you instant access. That's one. Two, if these orthopedic surgeons are assigned to a hospital, what you can do, because this is public information now because of all the various laws we have relevant to Freedom of Information Act, if they're a hospitalist meaning they're assigned to a hospital, working for a hospital, you can go to that hospital, look up orthopedic surgeons, and they have to reveal that entire list to you on their, typically on their website. That's a second way to get information. The third way, depending on the size of your geographic area in Florida, you can simply go in and ask for a list of orthopedic surgeons online in your, let's take an example, Orange County, which is Orlando, and you'll find all kinds of resources where they will give you a list of orthopedic surgeons. Now, do they all belong to the association? Probably, and here's the reason. Almost every medical profession requires continuing education credits. You go to the research center, look up orthopedic surgeon, you'll see the associations they belong to for CE credit. So the reality is you're pretty likely that most of these physicians, not just orthopedic surgeons, are going to belong to specialty groups in their area because they need to belong to that to get their CE credits. And that will give you a way to get membership information and start down that pathway. Vic?
Thank you. We have a couple of questions from Leslie, Richard. First one. Leslie asks, I'm getting into getting in front of centers of influence. I've found it's been exceptionally hard and sometimes actually impossible. My vertical markets are restaurants and chiropractors. Any insight you can provide to help me on getting in front of these COIs would be greatly appreciated.
Oh, absolutely, and thank you for that question. I would say, first things first, when you say getting in front of the centers of influence, I'm going to presume that you're suggesting the head of the association. Now, two things you need to think about. Number one, if I don't know your geographic area, but if you're in a large metroplex, like Atlanta, let's say that, these individuals are running fairly large associations and big functions. In other words, they may have 20, 30 people on staff. So first things first, if you can't get to the executive director, you could target the membership director and meet with them. Now, the important thing is, in the Accelerate Your Growth course on the Wildman Center, which is video number 6, that script is nearly bulletproof. You use that script when you call an association, you will not only be able to get the appointment, more importantly, be able to get in front of them. Secondly, and most importantly, if you don't have success with either one of those, the restaurant or chiropractors, if you have clients in that market, I would encourage you to ask a client and tell them, listen, as a restaurateur, I would like to meet with the head of the restaurant association here in our city and ask that individual to make the introduction for you. That has been wildly effective for people, is to get a client to make the call. Now, your question might be, well, why would a client make a call? If this person is a delighted advocate of the services you have, I can assure you, if you ask for help, we will help you. On the other hand, if every time we talk to you, business is fine, we're less inclined. So the reality is, you can simply say to this individual, if you have a client, listen, I enjoy working with restaurateurs. It's been, you know, great working with you. I would like to work with more restaurateurs. I'd like to meet the executive director of the Restaurant Association, Tom Wilkinson. Would you make an introduction for him and we could have lunch together and have a conversation? And my experience and the experience of hundreds of people is that your best client in that market will make the inquiry in entree for you. But failing that, if you don't have a client, then it's critically important. Target the membership director to get there from here as well. That's another good, that's a good start from there. Thank you. Because you had a couple
Thank
of questions.
Thank you, Ricky. Yeah, one more question that from this gal that I'd like to give you is from Leslie. And by the way, this is being recorded, so you will have a chance to view it later on the Wildman Center. And also, we're going to open it up to questions for all of you at about quarter of the hour. So if you've got questions or something that Richard's saying here triggers something, we'll have time for that. The second question is this, Richard, regards referrals. And what she says is, you have a larger personal budget than I do. And the offering to get together and treat prospects for dinners of 6 or so, or go on golf outing, for me is out of the question. Meeting for coffee is great for one-on-one, asking for referral business at that time as well, but it does not have the same impact as what you're doing. Do you have any suggestions, Richard? In other words, do you have to go big scale on this? Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I recognize you may be new to the business. You may have other financial pressures on you that don't allow you to go out and host a dinner for 6 or whatever the reference point of playing golf is. However, in Accelerate Your Growth in the Wildman Center, follow that script exactly. In other words, when you meet with somebody, don't ask for referrals. Here's 15 people I'd like to meet, 15 chiropractors, 15 neurosurgeons, 15 restaurateurs, whatever the case might be. But here are 15 people I would like to meet. And if this person's in that market, they're going to go right down that list for you. Now, I think your question is based on, well, what happens after that, though, when I say, you know, how should we get together? Should I do a golf outing? Should I do a dinner? And that's not the budget. No problem. Just think creatively. I mean, we've got a young guy up in North Dakota. He's brand new to the business. So his point is, when I host a little breakfast at McDonald's, I'd like to meet these people. And everybody laughs, but they come. Or he takes them for coffee. Listen, I'll do a little coffee thing at Starbucks. Why don't you invite 2 or 3 people to join us? And I'd like to have an opportunity to meet them face-to-face. Or another suggestion, instead of doing an event, how would I go about meeting these people? Could I join you at the association meeting as your guest, and you could introduce me? Or better yet, what would you do? Another situation with a young fellow, same young lady actually, in Phoenix, Arizona, she used that approach, and the guy said, well, why don't you come? You play golf? Yes. Well, why don't you come be our guest? I'll invite 2 of these good friends of mine. You can meet them. We'll play around to golf together. The total out-of-pocket to her was driving back and forth to the country club. So you don't have to take them to dinner or wine tasting or a golf outing. Those are simply suggestions. Think about what works for your market, what works for your budget. If what works for your budget is, you know, as an example, here are 15 people I'd like to meet. And so the guy says, or the gal says, okay, I know these six. Say, great, be my advisor for a moment. How would I go about meeting these people? Would you be willing to send them a note on my behalf introducing me? Or better yet, could I join you at the association meeting and get to meet them face-to-face? What would you do? And people are creative. They'll think of ways to make it happen. They might have something going on at their home. We got that guy in Orange County. He wanted to target the MG Club. He talked to the president of the MG Club as a client of his, and he said, listen, we're having MG Gymkhana. Why don't you come, be my guest, and I'll introduce you to everybody at the event. It was a $15 ticket to go. He spent the whole day doing the Gymkhana at the Four Seasons hotel parking lot, that parking lot in Orange County. How good was that? He got to meet everybody and a whole lot more people as well. So it's not about breakfast or lunch or a big golf outing. As much as it is, do something that fits for, A, your market, B, your budget, and it's okay if your ask is very small. Join you at the association meeting. I'll tell you what, I'm going to do a little breakfast at McDonald's, and people say, oh, that's ridiculous. Really? You'd be shocked at how many people say, hey, that'll work for me. I'm going to be in the business district. Why don't we invite two or three people? We'll have a little coffee and Danish at Starbucks. So your total, let's say, upfront, in all done cost, you get there early, put a table in the corner, they come in and meet, a little coffee, brunch, you're good to go. If you're targeting school teachers, I've got a young guy in Rhode Island. What he did, he has no budget. So he asked his principal, who's a client, how do I get in front of these people? Should I do, should I come to the teacher's meeting? What should I do? The guy said, no, why don't you bring donuts to the teacher's lounge? We all get together on Monday morning, have a little talk. And he said, I'd love to have you come in. I'll introduce you all the teachers in the school. Well, could you bring the donuts? How good is that? And it's the same approach. Hopefully that's helpful. So in other words, be sensitive to your budget and be sensitive to your market. I hope that's helpful for this young lady. Dick?
That's great. Yeah, a dozen donuts always wins the day, doesn't it, Richard?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to bore you all with stories, but I could tell you some stories that are just mind-numbing about donuts. But anyway, moving right along. Great for the police department. Look good at that. Anyway.
This next one harkens back to your comments on the men's warehouse, Richard. How does a universal value proposition differ from a mere slogan?
How does a unique value promise differ from a mere slogan? Well, that's
right.
An interesting question because I get at, you know, I do a lot. In fact, I did an interview today on Bloomberg Radio. The host asked a similar question. Well, doesn't a lot of companies have promises? They call them slogans. Well, let's be clear. A slogan is a promotional tool or concept that businesses use to drive interest in the marketplace. It can also drive sales. It can drive actions. It can drive service. But they're almost always universally company or seller-centric. I mean, think about, I mean, I can think of a half a dozen of AT&T, your world delivered. I just saw that ad this morning. Really? Is that a promise? Your world delivered. It's a slogan. Airbus, setting the standards, 3M, innovation. They're talking about themselves. There's no promise there. So as a result, most slogans are self-centric, and so they have a very short life. In contrast, the unique value promise establishes a practice, an advisor, a company in the marketplace as distinct from all others. And so what happens is you build a culture to deliver on that promise, a process, if you will, every single day. I mean, in our organization, Dick, you know, we have what we call our 10 service values for successful client relationships. You know, our value promise is elevating business performance in today's marketplace. And so we have a whole set of cultural values that our team follows to make sure we can deliver on every day. Now, if we had a slogan as a firm, Dick, well, then, of course, the values would have to change every time the slogan changed, or the slogan would simply drive activity, when, in fact, it's a promise of outcome, elevating business performance in today's marketplace. I'll tell you what, Dick, if you all want to send an email to me at richard@richardweilman.com, I'll send you, if you'd like, a copy of our 10 service values that we have that helps us be responsive to our promise at the marketplace and helps illustrate the difference between a slogan and a proposition, richard@richardweilman.com, and I'll alert the team to send that along to you if that's of some interest to you. our 10 service value. Dick?
Great idea, great idea. And the value promise has a shelf life. Slogan just has no shelf life at all. As you say, it just changes as the times change. The value promise becomes your touchstone. And speaking of that, another question that relates to this, Richard, following up on that. If having a unique value promise sets you apart, which you just articulated, what should be your response when someone asks you, why should I do business with you?
Well, again, this brings out another advantage of a UVP. It forever allows you to let go of the normal selling proposition in this old-school elevator speech. I mean, we're getting killed with this. I mean, the reality is when somebody asks you, why should I do business with you, or even what do you do, if you've got a UVP, whatever it is, tailoring financial strategies, putting your financial life in balance. I mean, I have no idea what it is, but if you ask your clients why, they're going to tell you why they're doing business, and I can assure you it's not good service and performance and all the things that we're being taught ad nauseum in this industry. The truth is when you ask people at a deep level, they come back with a completely different answer. So as an example, when we're asked this question and somebody says, you know, what do you do, or why should I do business with you? I always say what our best clients say we do for them is elevate business performance in today's marketplace. So, you know, if you had a printing firm, you could say what our best clients say we do for them is. I had a guy today, Dick, I won't mention his name. He's in Dayton, Ohio. It's a team that we've had the privilege of working with. This individual is working, he's being introduced tonight to an organization that he has targeted. He's got 30 words. That's his introduction. And the reality is that's what he's going to say. When he gets up, he's going to say, my name is... And I am a principal in the name of his firm. And what our best clients say we do for them in this space is, and the value promise that he's crafted, our coaching, his interviewing of clients, he's going to articulate his value promise. We know without a shadow of a doubt, people are going to come up afterwards and say, wow, how do you do that? Which is like an important and a great idea. So... the reality is when you have a value promise, it not only sets you apart, but it's a great response of why should I do business with you? What our best clients say we do for them is, and state your value. Nick?
Great. I know who you're talking about. Next question, and this is an important one. It talks about culture. What role, Richard, do you think culture plays in creating a customer-centric organization?
Well, I sort of spoke to that a little bit with our service values, but let me just say at a high level, culture is not something you install. I mean, I get those emails all the time. How do I get people to do what I want and have a culture that's customer-centric? Well, good luck with that. You know, culture is something you develop, you nurture, you educate, you compensate, you motivate. All of those things play a significant role in development and nurturing culture. So, you know, as a financial advisor, if you have working with you, as a financial professional, you have support staff, you have to flee ownership and pursue leadership. You have to set the stage and tone for all customer interactions. If your day is so crammed with appointments that your clients feel like you're rushing them, or your staff feels like you're jumping from one conference to the next, one call to the next, the reality is what you're saying is I'm just knocking this off. I'm just getting my list. You're not demonstrating that you're personalizing and humanizing the relationship. So, of course, it starts with your value promise of your practice to ensure it delivers. But, I mean, ask yourself, service exceptional or exceptional? Can your team make a decision without you being there, or do you have our policy? And I understand compliance, but I can't tell you how many people I talk to. They said, well, the FA really doesn't like me to do that. How is that possible? There needs to be a clear picture here. If you don't want them to do it, then you need to tell your staff why you don't want them to do that. Because the reality is employees, staff people, even agents, advisors that are educated on how to do the right thing, they'll do the right thing. I mean, Rich Carlton is a brilliant example. I mean, Dick, I'll be one next week in San Francisco. Rich Carlton again. It never ceases to amaze me. Every employee is continually trained, empowered, and rewarded for the actions they, shall we say, do on behalf of the guest. so they can expend time and effort and even money to deliver on their promise. They don't have to ask permission. So culture is something you develop and you nurture. And when you do that, then you become very customer, client, prospect, use any phrase you want, centric. And people pick up on it instantly. You know, how people say things is one thing, but you can pick up, if somebody says, well, I'm acting this way, but people read attitude. If the attitude of a staff person is, you know, I'm not really sure I should do this, I don't want to get in trouble, that's not good. I talked to a young lady this morning in Florida, and I'm setting an appointment there. I could be there at 3:15. She said, the only opening we have at 3 o'clock, but she said, I'm going to adjust the schedule right now. She said, no problem, it can be 3:15. I said, well, I thank you for that. She said, no problem, I have full authority to change every one of these calendars to accommodate our client. Now, how good is that? Versus, I got to check with the agent and see if he'll want to meet with you then. Think about it from that perspective. Dick? How many times did that?
Yeah, I got that a few times.
I had a girl tell me this week, let me see if he wants to talk to you. I was like, no. I have to ask him every time if he wants to talk to somebody calling in. I mean, is this a customer-centric culture? Of course, this guy's been called, he's called me like 4 times. And he's like, oh, Richard, I'm sorry, I wanted to take your call. I said, is this how you screen everybody? I said, oh, yeah, we screen everybody because I don't want to talk to everybody. This is great. This is a fantastic culture. So, you know, if you're qualified, I'll talk to you. If not, don't ever call me again. What are we doing here? Holy moly.